And our first presenter will be Ms. Tracy Wheat from the YMCA of the USA. Tracy Wheat joined the Y back in 2005 to head up the Pioneering Healthier Communities, or PHCs, which is a component of Activate America. Through Activate America, YMCAs are redefining themselves to better support Americans of all ages who are struggling to achieve and maintain well-being of spirit, mind, and body. Pioneering Healthier Communities is a community leadership initiative aimed at activating policy and environmental changes to improve community health by encouraging and supporting local communities in developing more effective strategies to promote healthy eating and physical activity. As project director, Tracy provides advice and consultation to 81 PHC teams in this initiative. She fosters partnerships nationally and locally and manages the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Cooperative Agreement and corporate and foundation donors funding for the initiative. Prior to coming to the Y, Tracy served 7 years at CDC in various capacities working at the National Center for Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion and also the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control. During this time, she worked with members of Congress, federal agencies, nonprofits, national organizations, state health departments, and others on policies and programs related to chronic disease prevention as well as injury prevention. Tracy also has Capitol Hill experience, as she was a health policy fellow to Senator Bill Frist, where she advised the senator on health policy matters. She has a Bachelor's of Science degree in biology from the University of Maryland and a Master's in Public Health from Emory University. So let's welcome Tracy Wheat. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm really excited to be here, and thank you, Michael, for that introduction to share with you some of the work that we're doing with YMCAs around the country. And Michael did speak a little bit in terms of our Activate America initiative. And Secretary Sebelius had mentioned that 6 in 10 Americans are trying to be healthier. And some of the data that we've been looking at, we're actually finding that it's around 65% of the people that we're working with are struggling with accomplishing their health and well-being goals. So back in 2004, the YMCA launched our Activate America initiative, and it's focused and looking at what we're doing not only internally, but also what we're doing externally to support this population, which we call as health seekers. And I know some people tend to fall in the programmatic mantra, but I should point out that this is really an organizational change process that we've been going through. So we're enhancing what we're doing internally, and we're also enhancing what we're doing with our partners as well. So I wanted to share with you, this is something, not to get caught into the details, but I wanted to focus on how, on the left, we've been focusing primarily on the already active population. And our goal is to focus on what's on the far right, is what we call health seekers. And again, we've realized that if we're to do our share in combating the chronic disease crisis in this country, we have to do things differently. And that's where Activate America comes in. For those of you who don't know much about the YMCA, or perhaps you know about working with your individual Y, we have a tremendous footprint across the country. There are 2,700 YMCAs. On an annual basis, we serve 20 million people, and we're in 10,000 communities. So for this organizational change process to occur, it's pretty intense, and we've been doing improvements along the way. Something that we adopted just a few years ago is what we refer to as capacity building. And this is a way in which we're providing resources, tools, and experiences in order for YMCAs to strengthen their capacity to serve this health seeker population. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because we want to focus on how we're mobilizing communities, but just to mention that we're better understanding this population, we're strategically using our data better, we're innovating our programs, and in fact, IDEO, who is a partner of ours, is actually in another session, I believe this afternoon, sharing some of the work that they've been doing on the innovation front. I wanted to spend more time today on two initiatives, one in particular, in which we're really doing our intensive work. Our GULA collaborative, which is down at the bottom, is focusing on our internal organizational process. Debbie Chang from Nemours yesterday had mentioned how they've been using the Institute for Healthcare Improvement through their work, and that's a model that we've been adopting in YMCA's to change what we're doing organizationally inside. Now what I'm going to spend most of our time today on is our Healthier Communities initiatives. And I wanted to go just a little bit deeper on this topic. In the past, many of the initiatives that have been operating in order to address physical inactivity and poor eating have been focused on the programmatic level, so addressing one individual at a time. And our goal is to truly take a more global focus and really work on policy and environmental change initiatives with multiple sectors. So we have a stronger sustainability. There is consistent messaging and policies that are supporting those health seekers. And so I wanted to highlight our three various initiatives. We've been very fortunate to receive funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and more recently the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Our Pioneering Healthier Communities initiative was launched in 2004, and this year we've been able to grow that program. That program has typically in the past really focused on planting seeds in the community, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is going to take a parallel approach in their funding to not only planting the seeds of that work, but also working on state-level action plans. So we're not only working on policies locally, but at the state level as well. And I should point out, I have two colleagues in the audience, Barb, who is helping us with Connecticut, and then Sam Becknell, who is also working on the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation-funded work as well. We've also been able to expand this approach through the Action Communities for Health, Innovation, and Environmental Change, or ACHIEVE initiative. And again, not going to go into details. We can have conversations about that. But quickly, all three initiatives have some common principles. First and foremost, when we started this initiative, based upon lessons from the STEPS program, REACH, Active Living by Design, we took what was happening and identified key principles that we wanted to emulate in this initiative. So one of the first things that we realized is we need to engage leaders. Not only are they important from an organizational perspective, and they can use their bully pulpit to really enhance whether it be work sites or students that they are the leaders of, but also they're very respected in the community. So not only can they adopt practices within their organization, but they can influence what's happening in the broader community. We also realized that we needed a multi-sectoral approach, and I know that's something that many people have mentioned before, and we found that very important. We learned that we can't only be talking to those people who have health as their priority, but to engage other sectors such as businesses, foundations, work sites. The Chamber of Commerce has been an incredible partner that we've been working with locally. As I mentioned, policy and environmental change is our focus, and I'll share with you some of the examples that we've been doing. Another principle that I think is critically important is we provide a lot of coaching to the teams and the communities that we're working with, but by no means do we give them a cookbook. As we all know, every community is different, and they're adopting these practices in an organic fashion to address their needs. And so depending upon what community we're working with and the needs of their community, they will adapt and adjust and develop their policy and environmental approaches targeted for that community. Throughout this process, the YMCA serves as the convener. And something that we learned in the first year was, in order for this really to be a community-based initiative, we need to do this with someone else within the community. So we co-lead this effort with a designated partner in our community. And as you would imagine, it runs the gamut in terms of the background of that person, whether it be someone from the health department, whether it be someone from the planning committee, the mayor's office, it really fluctuates across the board. Throughout this process, our goal is to really focus on community action planning. So once we have all these leaders together, they want to act. And so we work with them with mobilizing activities within their community that they can address, again, individually and as a whole. Here's a snapshot of one of the teams that we have, so you'll see that there are definitely a diverse group of entities at the table. And we've been fortunate because at the national level, we've been able to replicate many of the organizations that we're working with locally. And what's nice is we've been able to utilize these organizations, their resources, so we're not duplicating effort, but really embracing the hard work that they've done. And then we're also making sure that their members are connected to our work and our activities are connected to what's happening in the community. Because as we all know in this economic time, I think we need to be smarter in terms of our utility of resources. Here's a snapshot of currently where we're where we have sites. We have 101 sites right now, and we're just about to announce an additional 37 communities that we're going to be bringing together starting in September, which is pretty exciting. Here's some of the accomplishments that we focused on, and I've kind of split them between healthy eating and then more physical activity related. So some of the things that we've been able to do is in areas in which there is low access to fresh fruits and vegetables, we've been able to, whether it be on YMCA property or grounds, bring in fresh markets so people can access that food. We've been working with corner store initiatives, advocating for menu labeling, et cetera. On the physical activity front, we've been doing a lot of work, a lot with Mark Fenton, who I think is here. I know a lot of you saw yesterday. He's been wonderful and a tremendous resource of ours in helping communities better understand what's needed in order to change their environment. So as a result of his hard work and the people that we have gathered at the community level, we've been able to modify master plans that are being developed, put in, I hate to say this, but there are communities, especially in rural areas, that don't have crosswalks and countdown timers to really help people cross the street better. So we've been able to work on that front. Some of the teams have been bracing complete streets, which was mentioned yesterday as well, which is vital to ensuring that all modes of transportation are safe and people have access. In terms of key lessons, I'm going to highlight seven that we're going to be publishing later this fall, and this is through some of the work that we've culminated and culled through with some of our communities in terms of what's helping them act as a team and work in a collaborative fashion. So first and foremost is to start with a shared compelling vision and spirit of inquiry. So we've learned that, and I know we all live in communities in which this is the case, how many organizations have individual initiatives that are not working together? And so something that we try to do is come up with a broader vision in which all the activities happening in the community can fit under. So we have consistent messaging. And we also want to make sure that there's an open-minded process. So we're learning and adjusting and adapting to what's happening. And that's where the second one comes in, to adapt to emerging opportunities. There have been times in which some of our teams, and I'll give you an example, we have a team that right after we started working with them, they had an opportunity in which their mayor was developing their repaving plan, and this is in Birmingham, Alabama. And because of the information that they learned, the team learns, they were able to influence the city council and the mayor to actually put in things that were better for, again, pedestrians and motorists in the repaving plan. And it just so happened that the city council actually put on hold their vote because they thought it was very important to adopt these activities currently, because the next time they were going to be looking at the repavement plan was going to be probably 5 years down the road. So they were able to embrace that opportunity. Borrow from others and build from your own is another practice that we've embraced. A great example of that is in Louisville, in which they worked with the Food Trust out of Philadelphia in reference to their corner store initiatives and adopted what had been learning or the learnings from what was happening in Philadelphia, and have worked on two different corner store initiatives in the Louisville area in very poor areas that in which they don't have fresh fruit and vegetable access. Engage cross-boundary leaders who care. Again, this gets at the element in terms of really working outside our traditional partners, whether it be mass transit officials, whether it be extension services. we really want to look at who are some people in our community that we haven't worked with, and how can they embrace some of the work that we're doing. Become multiple role players. And I'm going to skip because I think develop leadership structures that distribute ownership and action are very similar. So when we're working on these initiatives, we've realized that we need to wear multiple hats. And we've also realized that we can't always lead all the time because we all have our experience and our assets. But we all know that and recognize that, you know, we don't do everything well all the time. And this is when our partners come into play. So how do we help embrace their assets and their skills and help raise what they're doing? And then finally, use data to guide, not drive, their efforts. And this is important because we all know the importance of data in terms of helping us make decisions and keeping us focused. But we've also observed that in some communities, they get so focused on having the right specific data that sometimes it impedes their ability to seek action-oriented activities. So this is something that we've been trying to do, a balancing act of making sure that once these community leaders are together and they want to take action, they want to see results, and we want to make sure that there's a balance in which they have the best data that can help guide their work, but it's not really driving everything to a T in terms of what they're doing. And finally, I just want to mention that in order for us to keep our eye on the prize, I really think we need to work together more collaboratively and embrace what each other are doing, because we all know that there are great activities happening around the country. How can we learn from each other? How can we share our skin knees? And how can we celebrate our successes together? So those are some of the activities that we're doing within the YMCA to address healthy eating and active living.
Okay. Thank you, Tracy. Yeah. Okay, our next presenter is Ms. Yvonne Garrett. Yvonne Garrett is the Director of Community Service at the City of La Mesa, California. Ms. Garrett has worked in community service for the last 27 years. First in the nonprofit world, and for the last 9 years in municipal government. She raised over $7 million in 2002 to 2004 to build a joint-use sports complex on a middle school. The complex is managed by the city and is shared. In 2005, Ms. Garrett created the La Mesa Wellness Task Force to combat childhood obesity in her community. Since then, the city has created a walkability plan and sidewalk master plan, as well as smoke-free parks. Currently, the city, school district, and county of San Diego are working on a cross-jurisdictional plan for community wellness. Let's welcome Ms. Yvonne Garrett.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to be here. And the focus of my presentation this morning is around mobilizing communities, but with a youth-based civic engagement. And this project really became about as a collaborative in San Diego County in 2004 when the San Diego County Board of Supervisors voted to support the idea of creating a childhood obesity master plan. And over a period of time involving lots of stakeholders, a plan was developed, and in 2006, the county released a call to action, the San Diego County Childhood Obesity Action Plan. And that action plan has a number of domains, seven in fact, which include business, media, and city and county government. And the focus of my presentation is how we have taken that domain and instilled the youth factor to create mobilized communities. The Communities of Excellence program is based on a statewide program that was developed by the Network for a Healthy California. And it was a community engagement and neighborhood indicator program that focused on three areas: one, nutrition, physical activity, and obesity prevention. And the idea was to assess neighborhoods to identify community strengths and gaps, and from that to select an advocacy issue and develop local action plans for policy, systems, and environmental change. San Diego built a localized version of this because they actually were not did not get the initial funding, and so decided to take the program and make it more localized for San Diego County. And what they decided to do was to use a youth-based focus in order to build capacity in communities. And the idea was to develop future leaders, obviously, and use mentoring strategies. And for this discussion, we're going to talk about the two pilot communities that led this effort. The first is Chula Vista, which is a community that's located next to the Mexico border in San Diego County. And they decided to partner youth and promotoras. The second community is the community that I'm from, and that's in La Mesa, California, which is adjacent to the city of San Diego. And our focus was intergenerational and youth working together. The process that we went through for the CX3 work was we garnered the youth together. We had weekly education meetings and trainings. We did advocacy training. And then we went out and did weekly neighborhood assessments, again, looking at the number and types of fresh produce in local markets and liquor stores, the number of fast food restaurants, the types of advertising and marketing that were in the selected neighborhoods, and whether the community was walkable. And then there was an analysis done of those surveys, and that was brought back to the youth, who then identified an issue that they wanted to advocate for. Each of these two projects is going to be described briefly. In Chula Vista, there was a park in the community that had been taken over by a homeless population. There was a high amount of drug activity. It was not a safe environment. It was not conducive to community participation. And so the youth decided to take back Lauterbach Park. And what they did was they advocated for community change through CEPTED, which is crime prevention through environmental design, and really talking about things that would make a park feel safe for the community to encourage residents to want to participate. And this is a picture of the reopening of the park. It was closed for 6 months after the youth advocated for it, and at the end of the day, they had a huge event that really encouraged the community to come back and take advantage of the opportunity of having green space. In Chula Vista, their next steps were that the built environment is not enough, and that in order for the park to stay safe, they needed to create activities in the park and create a social network to support the park. And so they created Adopt-a-Park, volunteer programs, community events, got the Chula Vista Community Collaborative engaged, and are now exploring community gardens with churches. And the youth are continued to be engaged in Chula Vista, continue to support increased physical activity in their community. In La Mesa, the youth, through the process of surveying, decided that there was a high school in their community that had no sidewalks to walk to it. And this is a picture of the road that the students had to walk on in order to go to school. It had no sidewalks, it had no lighting, unmarked crosswalks, little vegetation. It really didn't feel very pedestrian friendly. And so the students decided to advocate through the city council, through the school board, and actually even to Sacramento to improve their built environment by going to a number of these groups to advocate for their change. And interestingly, what they decided to do as part of their work was to create a website and a PowerPoint presentation that they showed before the groups. And so the first picture up above is actually the lack of sidewalk leading to the high school, and then they photoshopped an idea of what an appropriate sidewalk should look like. And this was pretty powerful when they went to the electeds to show that they had a vision for what the street should look like, including drought-tolerant landscaping. Additionally, the results of their work were that the students participated in a Safe Routes to School grant by contributing a photo essay and a letter of support, and the city was awarded $500,000 Safe Routes to School grants to add sidewalks to this high school, and in fact, as we speak, we are under construction now for sidewalks to that high school. In addition, the high school school board decided to improve and enhance the parking lot at the school site by adding landscaping and lighting. And then finally, the city council has now created a sidewalk master plan to identify places that would be important to have sidewalks added when infrastructure becomes available. And then finally, in this community, all the area within this localized area, the utilities are being underground to support future sidewalk additions. This year, actually in 2008, this program was awarded the Governor's Council on Physical Fitness for the best Parks and Rec program of the year because of the students' engagement and involvement. And since then, we've been able to leverage in our city $1.5 million in safe routes to school, not only for infrastructure upgrades, but to look at non-infrastructure upgrades in terms of program development around school sites to increase walkability and bikeability. And in conclusion, the shared strategies for the CX3 project are that obviously it engages and it empowers youth. And the youth are always so surprised when they go to electeds and the electeds listen to them and are really impressed by their work, and they'll come back and they'll say, I can't believe they listened to us. And so they really, you know, it's really a good learning experience for them to understand how valuable their voice is in their community and how much when they talk, people listen. We were able to leverage assets through multi-sector partnerships. We teamed up with diverse stakeholders, including the intergenerational opportunity that we worked with in La Mesa. And then clearly we were able to mobilize decision makers when the youth stood up and said, you know, I'm afraid to walk to my school because I may get run over by a car, especially if I'm walking after my sports. And so that's a pretty powerful statement for an elected to hear. And then we've been able to create sustainability because now all of a sudden we have a park in Chula Vista that is being used by the community. In La Mesa, we have an opportunity to leverage the money through the Safe Routes to School for infrastructure at 8 other elementary and middle schools in our community. So again, creating more of a walkable community in a very urban environment. And then clearly engaging youth in community issues really sets the stage for their future visioning and really reinforces us explaining to them how important community service is as a long-time commitment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Yvonne. Our next presenter is Ms. Kate DuPont Phillips. So as Yvonne is preparing the slides and for Kate, I'll just kind of give you a little information about Kate. She's a program and policy analyst with the Nemours Health and Prevention Services. Ms. Phillips earned a bachelor's degree in physical education and sports medicine from the University of Virginia and a master's degree in public health from Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. Her experience includes health education, health promotion, dissemination, and implementation of best practices, and technical assistance on healthy eating, physical activity policies, and programs, with the focus on decreasing the prevalence of overweight in Delaware's children. So let's welcome Ms. Kate Phillips.
Thank you for having me. You heard Debbie Chang speak a little bit yesterday about some of the Nemours experiences in attempting to reduce the prevalence of overweight and obesity. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about some of our work in a little bit more detail. So the background on Nemours is that our division, Nemours Health and Prevention Services, is a division of Nemours, which is a pediatric health care system. It's one of the largest in the nation, with a hospital in Delaware and outpatient clinics in Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Florida. So our Nemours Health and Prevention Services division was created about 5 years ago with the idea that Nemours wanted to expand as an organization to address not only treatment in children, but also prevention. So our first initiative at NHPS in Delaware is to focus on reducing the prevalence of overweight and obesity in children. And this is why, because about a third of Delaware children, over a third, 37% are overweight or obese. So our division's goal, 2015 goal, is to reduce the prevalence of overweight in Delaware children, those specific ages, from 37% to 35%. And the way we're trying to do this is by taking a population-oriented approach. So we look at the socio-ecological model, and we're trying to address multiple levels of the model because we know that multi-factor interventions are the most effective. So we're doing work at the society level through societal policy change at the state level in Delaware, also through work on the built environment, work in the community through community-based coalitions, and work at the organizational level through changing policies and practice and in multiple sectors. Those include schools, child care organizations, primary care organizations, and after-school programs. So we're basically focusing on the top three levels of the socio-ecological model at this point and focusing on systems and environmental changes. And all of those changes, we want to support 521 Almost Done behaviors. 521 Almost Done is our healthy lifestyle message at Nemours. You've probably heard some version of it. There are a number of them across the country. So 5 stands for 5 or more servings of fruits and vegetables a day. 2 is 2 or fewer hours of screen time a day. 1 is almost, or 1 or more hours of physical activity a day, and almost none is almost no sugary drinks. So we want all of the policy and practice changes we work on to support kids in increasing opportunities to practice those behaviors. So I mentioned a community-based coalition that's part of our efforts in bringing together those different sector players in a community place-based strategy. We also implement a social marketing campaign. There are two, basically. One promotes 521 Almost None, the message to parents and children, and another is aimed at policymakers, and the main message for that is kids can't do it alone. Using the best available evidence is really a core part of our strategy. We don't want to reinvent the wheel, so we're looking at using successes in fields other than obesity and best and promising practices to make sure our work is as effective as it can be. So I'm going to focus on communities, mobilizing communities, specifically through creating communities of practice. So I'm going to ask you to kind of step outside of the traditional view of a community as a geographical community and think about communities of practice. So basically what we've done is bring together partners, similar partners, in 3 different settings, one being childcare, another primary care, and the last school districts. And our goals in creating these 3 different groups, bringing them together, are to give them the knowledge and tools they need to change policy and practice at the organizational level. And through that work, we've seen some barriers, which you're all probably very familiar with. Inadequate resources, obesity falling is a very low priority on the list of other things partners have to do, and a general lack of knowledge about what they could be doing that would work best. So our support for partners in these initiatives were, we created learning collaboratives, one for each of those 3 groups. We provide them training and technical assistance and a number of materials and toolkits. So I'm going to talk a little bit about our learning collaboratives. Each of those 3 learning collaboratives went through similar processes, all of which included needs assessment, formal or informal PDSA cycles. Our primary care group did formal cycles. Our schools and child care groups did much less formal cycles. But generally, the steps the groups went through were plan, do, study, and act. So in the planning stages, we went through some knowledge transfer, us, NHPS, to them, and then them back to us in terms of what they thought would work in their specific settings. Action planning. And then in the do phase, they implemented the changes they decided would probably be feasible. They studied and brought back to the group their feedback on the changes. They shared lessons learned in their learning collaborative and then went about some group problem solving. And then the acting phase is taking what they have learned and either making improvements on the change they had initiated or, if the change went well, to pick a new one to work on. So a number of the tools we provided them throughout this learning collaborative process were materials and toolkits, a number of website materials that are all up on our website for them, and then in one collaborative we provided them an extranet so that all of the materials they used throughout the learning collaborative were up on the site. It was a private protected site, and they also used it to report data back to us. So I'll touch on each of these learning collaboratives briefly to give you an idea of the process and what we were able to, the changes we were able to see. So our child care learning collaborative happened over the course of a year, 4 sessions, and we invited 28 organizations to send small teams to a learning collaborative. So those teams usually were made up of 2 or 3 people. And these 4 sessions throughout the year, they came to and took materials back to their child care center to train the rest of their staff. They received a number of materials, both curricula they could use in the classroom, as well as suggested policy changes. This happened at about the same time that we were working at the state level on changing regulations in the Office of Child Care Licensing and updating the Child and Adult Care Food Program Nutrition Guidelines. So what we ended up with were improved nutrition in the CACFP program through a partnership of us and the Delaware CACFP, and it ended up being a larger win than we expected because the Office of Child Care Licensing in Delaware requires all child care providers to follow the CACFP guidelines whether or not they're participating in the program. So we now have all Delaware child care sites in Delaware following these new improved CACFP guidelines. So throughout the child care collaborative process, we saw a number of positive changes. The goal is obviously to make these changes sustainable. So centers have now the tools they need to make practice changes on site. They have curricula, they have recommended policies and practices, they have DVDs to train their staff. So through that collaborative, we saw increased healthy eating and physical activity practices in the providers. So some of the examples are that providers were role modeling healthy behaviors for kids. Some centers created policies that stated that staff were not able to bring in junk food any longer because they didn't want the kids to see the difference in behaviors they were recommending and what staff were actually doing. So that was a big win. We saw decreases in sedentary time at the centers and decreases in screen time, as well as increased physical activity done throughout the day. School District Learning Collaborative, similar process. We invited a number of small school teams from school districts across the state of Delaware. And the teams often consisted of a nurse, an administrator, a classroom teacher, a phys ed teacher, and someone from nutrition services. That's just sort of the general makeup of a team. And the focus of the school district learning collaborative was to review their wellness policies, since those are mandated, and to improve them. So these teams went about doing that. Similar structure and process. We brought them together multiple times over the year, and during the periods in between, they worked on improving their wellness policies and implementing the policies. So one of the things we saw when we reviewed the policies in the beginning was that nutrition education was one of the strongest components of the wellness policies, and monitoring and evaluation was one mostly the weakest. So some of the changes we saw in after working with these school districts together in a collaborative are 80% of the district's nutrition services are making strides in improving nutrition, 100% of the districts are making strides in meeting 150 minutes of PE and PA a week, and then 48 elementary and 18 middle schools are adopting Catch and Take 10. So those are two of the promising practices we promoted to schools. We also initiated a learning collaborative with primary care providers, which we felt was really important since we're a healthcare system, so we're trying to get our providers to follow best practices as well. So through that initiative, we're reaching over 50,000 children, and then the goal of the initiative is to support primary care providers as well as school-based wellness centers in the prevention, identification, and management of childhood overweight. So some of the things we've seen from the provider QII, the Quality Improvement Initiative, are that 99% of our providers nearly are classifying BMI or weight for length now at well child visits. 87.5% use our 521 Almost None survey during well child visits. Basically what we did was provide them a survey that asked children how often they do the 521 Almost None behaviors, so that providers can get an idea of which behaviors children are actually able to do and which they're having challenges with. It also assessed readiness to change. So providers had that tool to use for assessment. That's on our website if you're interested as well. 84 similar percentage of providers also provided counseling on healthy lifestyle at well child visits. So a component of the Quality Improvement Initiative was also training providers on motivational interviewing, which was one of the most valuable training experiences they had during that collaborative. I'm going to skip that slide. So in terms of results, we have every 2 years, we started in 2006, We field the Delaware Survey of Children's Health. We don't have the data from the 2008 survey yet, so we don't have data on child-level behavior change. However, we have seen a number of positive changes in policy and practice at the organizational level, at the state level, and at the community level. So we know we're making positive headway in those different areas. So here are some lessons learned generally from our work with partners. Persistent education on the value of health promotion and disease prevention is necessary. Prevention often falls very low on the list of priorities, especially when you're working with organizations for which health promotion is not a priority. It's not in their mission. So you have to kind of try to keep it at the forefront of their minds. Determining value for partners, this is a big one. Change is not going to be sustainable if partners don't value the changes that you're trying to work with them to make. So, you know, if funding comes around from a different stream in a year or your funding disappears, your partnership disappears, your work has to have value for them to make sure that they continue doing it. Recognize competing priorities. All of our partners have priorities outside of health promotion or disease prevention. We have to recognize that and try to work with them to integrate it into what they're already doing. Be clear on mutual expectations. It's a pretty easy one. Long-term commitment is critical. Trust is essential. Both of these things kind of emphasize the need to be in it for the long haul with a partner. You can't expect changes to happen quickly. Takes years in some cases. Don't reinvent the wheel. This is a big one. We very much focus on using evidence to inform our work, also best and promising practices and anything we can take from research to translate into practice. Learn how to say a polite no thank you. This is really challenging. We get, through working with so many valuable partners, we get lots of opportunities to do really great things. They are all good opportunities. However, a lot of them are small projects that we are just not able to do to keep ourselves on strategy and to reach our goal. So sometimes it's important to be able to say no to things that may be good but might distract you from your overall mission. And again, need to be nimble to take advantage of opportunities. So lots of times opportunities arise that you didn't plan for, but that can really help you impact your strategy. So it's important to be able to shift things around sometimes to take advantage of those things. That could be big wins for you. And then generally just lessons learned from communities of practice. We know that communal learning works. We went into these learning collaboratives not with the idea that that we were creating communities of practice. We really went in with the idea that it was the most efficient way to reach large numbers of organizations, which it turned out to be. It also turned out to have a number of benefits beyond that. Some of them are listed here. Problem solving amongst groups, requests for information, seeking experience, sharing assets, coordinating. There are lots of benefits that organizations can get from working with one another, similar organizations, learning from one another, sharing successes and challenges beyond which we could have communicated to them. And all of our learning collaborative partners found the participation in these ventures very helpful to them. So that's just a thought is to, I encourage you as you think about mobilizing communities to think outside of the box, not just about geographic communities, but also about creating communities of practice. Thank you.
Thank you, Kate. Our next presenter is Ms. Julia Bloom, and she's project manager for the Change Study at the John Hancock Center for Physical Activity and Nutrition in the Gerald J. and Dorothy R. Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University in Boston. Julia received her master's in public health, concentrating in social and behavioral science from the Boston University School of Public Health, and her BS in psychology from Xavier University in Cincinnati. Julia's professional interests include child health and development and issues of health disparities. She previously worked as a research associate for innovations, improving health and social disparities through academic community partnerships at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, and as a research assistant in the psychology division of that medical center. So let's welcome Ms. Julia Bloom.
Thank you. So as Michael mentioned, I'm the project manager for the Change Study at Tufts University. And the Change Study is a research initiative, a randomized control trial that's designed to adapt, implement, and evaluate community-based childhood obesity prevention intervention in 8 communities, 4 intervention and 4 control communities that are located in 4 rural regions of the United States, in the states of California, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Kentucky. The principal investigator on this grant is Christina Economos, and it's funded by Save the Children U.S. programs. The study began in 2007 and started with some planning and training and partnership building time, and the intervention began in the fall of 2008, spanning 1 school year, just ended last month. So we do not have our data compiled and ready to share with you today, but we'll be looking forward to getting that information together soon. So today I want to talk to you about the progression of alliance and partnership building that it took to implement the intervention in our communities and to ultimately create hopefully sustainable change in our intervention communities. And I'll also point out some key partnership building strategies that we utilized along the way. So the first partnership that was formed was between Tufts University and Save the Children U.S. programs. Tufts, and specifically Chris Economos' work, has been focused on developing and evaluating community-based approaches to decreasing childhood obesity. And the intervention model was shown to be successful in an urban setting in decreasing unhealthy weight gain in children in Somerville, Massachusetts, during the Shape Up Somerville intervention. The goal of the intervention is to make changes in all of the environments of a child's day that they would encounter, so before, during, and after school, and in the reinforcing environments of their home and community, with the ultimate goal of increasing daily physical activity, access to healthy food and beverages, and to reduce leisure screen time. Save the Children has been working for some time in rural communities. They focus on health, development, and literacy programs for children living in these areas, and they recognize childhood obesity as a very important issue that was happening in these communities where they were working, and they wanted to launch an obesity prevention campaign that could reach as many people as possible. So they knew of the work going on at Tufts University and approached Dr. Economos to see if the Shape Up Somerville model could be replicated in a rural setting. The first phase of the partnership building between Tufts and Save the Children began in 2006, and that was focused on formative research in the 4 rural areas of California, Kentucky, Mississippi, and South Carolina, where Save the Children was already working. Together, we conducted school policy and environmental assessments, focus groups, built environment assessments, and a photo voice project with teachers and school staffs in some of the school, basically taking a qualitative approach to try to understand the landscape of childhood obesity in these regions, to understand generally what was going on in these regions and what the communities were like, and to understand what about the landscape was influencing childhood obesity. The second phase of the partnership building has been to develop and implement the Change Study. Basically, it's an intervention designed to decrease excess weight gain using an adapted Shape Up Somerville model with implementation strategies that have been derived from our formative research, and all the while trying to incorporate as many community participatory principles as we could into the study design to help build community capacity and to create tailored, feasible, relevant, and sustainable changes in the intervention communities. So one of the first differences in trying to adapt and replicate a community-based intervention in a rural setting was the question of how we were going to define community. And ultimately, we decided the most natural and consistent definition that we could use for the Change Study would be to use the definition of the elementary school community. We would be working from the school outward in all of the places of the community where students and their families lived, worked, and played. This was supported by results from our formative research, suggesting that the definition of what one considered to be their community was not necessarily the definition of geographical boundaries. Also, the results presented a consistent perception of the school as a community center. Many events and outreach programs happened there. People were used to congregating there, and it was seen as a central physical location in some very residentially dispersed areas. So in the intervention schools, we began to build our partnerships with the schools through site visits and meetings. And really three key things happened to strengthen our partnerships right from the beginning. The first was that we committed to provide all funding and resources for the project. The second, the school committed to implement a few core intervention elements from the beginning that were more easily translatable into a rural setting. And the third was that Save the Children issued funding to the school to hire a full-time local change study coordinator. As I mentioned earlier, we tried to incorporate as many community participatory strategies as we could into the study, and hiring a full-time local coordinator in each intervention community who knew about their community could lead their community in developing and implementing a tailored intervention plan, and who could hopefully remain a champion in the community long after the close of the study was very important for these efforts. So after a coordinator was hired and in place in all of the intervention schools, in the four intervention schools, there was some simultaneous partnership building going on between the local coordinator and the school, and the local coordinator and Tufts and Save the Children. So the coordinator sat within the school, so they became a part of the school community. They got involved in school activities, got to know students and families, and started to understand opportunities for change and the needs of the people that were at the school. Our relationship with the coordinator began to develop through professional development training, guidance in assessing and communicating with their school and community to help develop an intervention plan and timeline. We provided technical assistance and supervision of the project activities, and developed and provided any resources that they needed. As the relationship between the school and the change study staff and the local coordinators grew, the coordinator was able to start to understand the resources and networks in their community, and they began to identify the players and stakeholders that they would need to work with. They realized the connections that could be made and the coordination that could help move their efforts forward. So we started the intervention activities and the partnerships in the school and moved outward, as I said. So we first started training staff and introducing a curriculum, worked with the food service department to improve the food that they offered in the school meals and to purchase new equipment that they needed and to train staff on anything that they needed to serve that type of food. We began family outreach activities and held events at the school that welcoming community members. With the buy-in for their efforts building in the community, combined with the established and trusted position of the school in the community, and along with continued support and resources and guidance from Tufts and Save the Children, the coordinator was able to create alliances with community partners that were necessary to make environmental and policy changes in the community. So our key strategies to building partnerships in these rural areas were utilizing a community academic partnership to bring evidence-based childhood obesity prevention strategies to underserved communities, utilizing community participatory strategies wherever possible, partnering with the central community organization that was identified in our formative research and as the cornerstone in the community was very important because we needed their buy-in and support to do anything, and also gave credibility to the project early on and gave access to community partners that we needed to work with. Something that I know we wish we had even more of was time, but time to understand the community and to allow the relationships to develop was very key. Implementing the intervention elements in the school early that were easily translatable to the rural setting was important to show early success and to build momentum. building community capacity through professional development trainings. And also, I think Kate just mentioned this, bringing awareness to childhood obesity and incorporating it into the shared agenda of child health and child welfare in communities with limited resources and where other issues like drugs and alcohol and poverty were identified as more immediate and pressing changes. I want to acknowledge some people here that are working with us and also our change study coordinators.
Thank you, Julia. Okay, as I stated during the beginning of the session, we wanted to try to have some time for us to sort of do some questions from the audience as well as some kind of a town hall type setup. But I'd just like to start by asking the panelists a quick question. What impact does the involvement of communities have on policy and environmental activities?
I can speak a little bit to that. It's key because if you're dealing with elected officials, they want to hear from their constituency. And so whether it's older adults who are engaged with the youth, as in our CX3 project, or if it's other neighbors and community stakeholders, you have to have community engaged in order to have policy change, because that's the only way that electeds really will sit up and take notice.
I would echo what Yvonne said, too. In various communities that we've been working with, whether it be working on our shared vision, we've had community buy-in participating in that, whether it be the restructuring or redevelopment of areas. We've been working with folks to embrace this concept of charrettes. I don't know if that's familiar with many people, but really engaging community members in the process in terms of various planning elements that are happening. But as Yvonne said, too, especially when you're working with policymakers, one of the most persuasive ways to get them to sign on to things is when you have the community members standing before them and informing them of what's happening and what's needed in the community and helping to influence those decisions. So it's vital, we've learned.
My name is Amy Barone. I'm Communications Director of HealthCorps. We're a health, well, really a proactive health movement founded by Dr. Mehmet Oz. But a big part of what we do is we have a health educational mentoring program in high schools. And with the launch of Dr. Oz's talk show this September, we're going to pose a challenge to communities, about 11 communities across the country, mostly where we have our program. We're in 50 schools in 9 states. And I was, amazed listening to you. I was wondering what you found are some of the more subtle problems that might not meet the eye in controlling obesity, because we are targeting teens and their families and the community at large. But some of you are, talking to medical providers and grade school children. And also, I was curious about the success of the photo voice technology, which we'd like to use as we start off.
The photo voice was a great way for us to get information. Specifically, we were asking about the opportunities and barriers to physical activity in the area. So it was really amazing. In the 4 different regions, very different themes came up, and some very similar themes came up. So whether in the transportation is really an issue across the board, and got some great creative pictures of some transportation barriers and also things like snakes in Kentucky. And unexpected things came up as well that we may not have known going into it. So it was a really great way to get some perspective and some information about issues we may not know about.
I'd absolutely echo that on photo voice. It's a really great method to get to those unknown sort of factors. Engaging youth is obviously a great strategy generally, since you will often come up with ideas that may not work for youth, they're not really interested in. Another program that we've used in Delaware is called Students Taking Charge, which engages youth in creating policy and practice change in their school environment through needs assessments and looking at the specific things they think should be changed, which are sometimes different than the things we think should be changed. So that's something to consider as well.
Hi, I'm Jerry Schultz. I'm with the University of Kansas. Just a quick question around, a simple question. How do you sustain the mobilization effort? Often they're started with external resources and things of that sort. How do you see sustaining the mobilization effort over the long term?
With the CX3 project, when we went into it, we knew it was going to be a one-time opportunity with this group of youth who were engaged. And what we decided to do in our case to sustain the youth engagement piece was to ask our youth commission, which is an appointed commission appointed by the city council, to take on the continual dialogue about community wellness in our community on as a work project. So now for every opportunity we've had, and there's been two in the last year, to apply for Safe Routes to School grants or to look at how we might improve our built infrastructure in our city, we've gone to the Youth Commission and actually asked them to conduct a walk audit of the park or the streets that we have been considering prior to us deciding whether or not to move forward, so that we continually have that body engaged. So for us, the key has been looking at an existing organization or entity that we can convince or invite or get them to agree to take this on as a work plan for continuity and sustainability.
For our initiatives, sustainability is something that's on our mind from the very beginning, because all the sites that we give, we don't give them a lot of funding. So from the very beginning, we establish that sustainability is something that they're going to have to focus on and work on from the very start. You know, with budgetary cuts, therein lies a challenge, but I think the most amount of funding that we've given one community is $75,000. Which is a small amount of money for the hard work that they're doing. Some of the challenges that we've had, but I think it also reminds me of the opportunities, is because we have a leadership model. Leaders evolve, they retire, they move to different communities. And so something that we're trying to incorporate a little bit more, and I'm excited to hear the utilization of youth, is how are we training or embracing youth as future leaders? Because in order for us to truly keep this moving along from generation to generation, we need to be investing in coaching and really mentoring them to be leaders within their communities. So I would suggest, you know, with anything that we do, you know, thinking of sustainability from the very beginning is essential. And I know sometimes people think that that's just all about money. And don't get me wrong, money is vital and it's critical and important, but I think we need to be a little bit more creative in terms of how we're sustaining this work. And through some of the initiatives that we're working on, you know, one of our communities just influenced one of their master plans that, if I'm not mistaken, it's like for 2035. So if that's something that we can help influence from the very beginning, that's critical to making sure that those environmental elements that we think are important transcend decades. We need to be there from the very beginning in helping to influence those policy decisions that are being made.
Yeah, I just want to mention three things briefly. One, I think, is very much dependent. Sustainability is very dependent on whether or not your partners value what you're doing. If you can fit, if they don't value it, they're not going to do it, or they'll do it for a short time and then they'll stop doing it. So it's really important to find a shared value with a partner. For example, the way we did this with schools is, we all know schools are very challenged in time and their focus is on academics. So we shared with schools through the Learning Collaborative a lot of data on how physical activity improves academics. And really, that was one of the things that they really grasped onto and used to justify our shared value. Another is trying to integrate projects or work generally into things that already exist, and not to create, if possible, not to create new groups, not to create new projects, but to kind of root out where existing groups might take something on as part of their mission. And another is infrastructure. If the infrastructure for sustainability doesn't exist, then it's necessary to build it, and hopefully you can build it in a way that ensures it will still be there after you leave. And so we've tried to do that, again, through learning collaboratives, because our approach was we didn't want to bring people together and share knowledge, and then when we step away, there's no way for them to continue to receive that knowledge. So one way we did that was through doing a lot of train-the-trainer approaches. So hopefully we'll have trainers in existence after we pull out a little bit, and also in creating materials that organizational partners can continue to use after we're gone. So we try to give them all the information that they need so that they're not dependent upon us in the future. So those are just three factors I think are important.
I hear a lot of assumption and some really cool success stories about the power of engaging different types of stakeholders in this work, particularly young people. And I'm curious, though, if we have any hard data that shows the efficacy of engaging, say, youth as partners in this work that goes beyond success stories, beyond anecdote, and actually gets into quantifiable data that I can share with decision makers in school buildings and in districts around my state to help promote this idea further, in addition to other stakeholders as well as young people. Do you have any kind of data that supports it beyond a great idea?
No, what we use in terms of the success rate is the opportunities for additional funding that we've been able to bring into our community to add infrastructure. And so when we're able to identify that to our policymakers and say that because of the work that the youth have done, we've been able to add, you know, $1.5 million to the capital improvement project budget, then that usually gets their attention.
And we've been looking at that question in particular, and our preliminary data is reflecting that that's the case, but we don't have enough data in which we feel comfortable to come out and say that that's for sure, but I'm happy to talk to you afterwards and share with you some of the findings that we've had. We haven't looked at youth in particular, but engaging key leaders is what we've been interested in.
Okay, everyone, I'd like to thank our panelists, and if you can join me in thanking our panelists. And thank you for your time and your participation.